Welcome to ITE 1, Chapter 9, Part 2, Semester 2. Geez, the introductions get longer every week, don't they, everybody? Well, it's Elise Lonsdale broadcasting from the training room in Perth. And I've been here for nearly a week and I have about a day of my holiday to go. So, feel privileged that I've actually come in to do my lecture and broke into my holiday, guys. Because it's been a lovely trip so far. Perth is a lovely city. Last week we started chapter 9 and we came in and we discussed many things, and I had my notes as they should be. We discussed things like security threats, web security, and I think I might have done a little bit on websites security. We talked about DDoS, DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service attacks. We discussed viruses, Trojans, greyware, malware, underwear, you name it, we had it. And we we explained social engineering, we explained spam and pop-up windows, pop-under windows, and all these other little nasty bugs and things that just go around and look to destroy your computer experience when you're on the internet. So, if people have listened to the lecture or read their notes, does anyone out there have any questions? Well, it either means we're all asleep or everyone's understood it so well we can all go home. Okay. Someone's gone to sleep over the other side of the room. Well, that's a good start. Okay, what else did we do last week? We talked about a phenomenon known as social engineering. Now, can anyone tell me what social engineering was?
Do I count as anyone, or?
Yeah, you can have a go at that, Jackie. It's up to you.
Basically, social engineering is when someone pretends to be a trusted source and tries to get information from other individuals.
Like somebody might, for example, ring up the help desk, ring up a person and say they're from the help desk and say, we're making some server upgrades in the middle of the night and we need your username and password, but that's all right, well, you can reset your password in the morning. So the user gives out the username and password and bingo. Yep, that's exactly right. Another one might be, for example, somebody's pretending to be a trusted organisation and offering you a file to install. Yep, thank you, you've just installed a virus. Goodbye, computer. And there's many other sort of forms it takes. Does anyone want to have a go at phishing? Phishing's always a popular one to talk about when we're doing these sort of discussions.
Yeah, I like Flathead.
You do? Good. And Murray Cod and
Red Emperor is my favourite.
Catfish.
Yeah, Barry Mundy's always good up in the territory.
Yes, Spanish man.
Okay. I myself enjoy bass fishing.
Is that GW Bass or Microsoft QBass?
And you can always throw a line in and get Kerry stirred up, you know. So, yeah, well, this is PHISHING. And, of course, Mark, do you remember what phishing was? We did discuss it last week. You're a student.
Yeah. Isn't that sort of... Yeah. And... Method of... Also, another method of trying to get information, or rather...
Well, yes, but what sort of information and how?
It's where you might get an email and kind of hook you in to open an email and get your all your goodies that way.
Well, yeah, I was looking for a little bit more specific than that. Have you ever seen those emails where, for example, you say your account has been cancelled or compromised and you have to log on? And your bank account might be at risk, and we need you to verify your information. So what you do is you log onto a website that might...
Oh, speaking of that, you guys, I have some good news.
Go ahead.
There's this Nigerian guy, and he actually died, and he wants to leave all this money to me. All I've got to do is give him my bank details so I can have him put the money into my account. How kind!
Oh, look. I knocked back one last week. I think you were going to give me $500,000. It's good.
Oh, these poor people, they're dying all over, and they're so generous, too.
I actually got one that said I won the UK lottery, I think about a week or two ago.
I won it, too.
I think we all got it. I think it came to the instructor's address.
So it means Kerry, Grace, and I are sharing the prize.
And Kieran.
And Kieran, and probably... And Jenny, and Mark, and Jackie, and Geraldine, and everyone all sharing, this prize.
Interesting story about this, though. Yeah. Can you just unmic up for a second, Mark? I realise you've got something to say in a second, but you're looping audio back. Interesting thing is that Ian actually was getting spam in his curtain inbox, and interestingly enough, the message that said that Cisco had given us $80,000 was right next to one that said that could he please deal with $300,000 from Africa. So no you way. Actually have to watch the email very carefully, because there was actually a legitimate one from Cisco saying we've given you $80,000, which was back in 2007, so nobody get too excited.
We're not rich yet.
Go for it, Mark.
Okay.
I'm guessing that PayPal one that keeps popping up in my Hotmail account, and it's not even a PayPal address.
No, there's something with PayPal that you should probably do with it if you think of it, is forward it to spoof@paypal.com so they can investigate them.
Yeah, they're pretty good like that. I've had a number of PayPal. You know, you have to log in and verify your details, and it's not really cool.
I don't even use Hotmail as my PayPal email.
I don't know what email address you've got. They'll send it. They'll just. I've got a. You know, I've got my business one. You know, lisa@lonestarmedia.com.au. All the spammers know about it, and they'll send me all sorts of bank. Westpac. Actually, Westpac is one of our banks we have here in Australia. Western Pacific Banking Corporation is its full name, and they've just revamped their website, as in like. Made it the front end completely all different, which is fine, and I must admit I really checked it out thoroughly to make sure I was on the right website when I first saw it. 3 days later, yep, you guessed it, it was, we've just updated our website, you need to log in and verify your account. Yeah, right, so the spammers are watching. It looked nothing like the website, because I think the spammers, at the coding people at the spammers lab or whatever they have hadn't got round to mimicking the website, but it was one of these, you know, messages, get on and, you know, verify your account or else the world will end. So you don't want to do that, guys, because you are actually giving your username and security details to a person or persons unknown, and you will find that your bank account will get cleaned out very quickly. So
just a point. Does anybody ever read the print that says PayPal will never ask you to click on a link? PayPal will never ask you for your username and password. PayPal will never ask you to provide this information. I realise that the terms and conditions and stuff are really quite boring, and there are hundreds of more interesting things to do, but if you're going to link a site with your financial account, take one read through them and take a note of the things that PayPal will never do. And one of the things they will never do is ask you to click a link. In fact, they tell you that you should go to https://www.paypal.com in your browser. So really look at those things, and that way you will know that they are actually phishing scams. And just take a look at those security guidelines on sites, because they will save you potentially hundreds of dollars. It only takes for a person to slip up once, and your information is out there.
And I actually really have seen PayPal ask for people's, say your account's been compromised, log in and straighten it out before, so... You can have your account compromised, and they will send you an email, but all they'll say is straighten it out. You'll go to the page, and you'll see something about your account being compromised, and they'll let you do it from their website. Never click the link, because you just log in, and they'll have you take care of it from there.
But they don't ever send you a link.
No, they never send you a link, but they will send you a little email saying your account's been compromised. Come to PayPal and take care of it.
Now, I know even with the Australian financial institutions, they tend to say, I get letters from legitimate emails from Westpac saying my statement's ready to download. And it's always in the footer at the bottom, you know, Westpac will never send you a link on which to click, etc. So, yeah, that's a little bit there on phishing. Some basic precautions to prevent about this sort of stuff is, obviously, it's pretty simple, common sense, never give out your password. Always ask for ID of unknown persons. Restrict access to unexpected visitors. This gets back to something we touched on last week, where if there are people wandering around your place of employment, know who they are. I'll give them a visitor's pass. Or escort them, even better. Escort all visitors, that's the next point. Never post your password or write it down and put it in your work area. Lock your computer when you leave your desk. I think this provoked some conversation last week. And do not let anyone follow you through a door that requires an access card. Are we right at that point, guys? The next one is in the notes. Sorry, somebody wanted to speak?
No, I was going to just say pretty good. Let's move on.
Good. Excellent. Well, I hope you're out there practicing all those things, Mark. That's good. So don't let anyone in your house you don't know. TCP/IP attacks. TCP/IP is the protocol suite that enables us all to hear or talking on the internet. Wow. Unfortunately, it can also make a network vulnerable to attackers. We've got, I think we did touch briefly on this last week, we had the SYN flood attack, S-Y-N, I think it was spelt. The DOS, the distributed, or the denial of service attack. Does anyone remember what that actually is before we go on? Leon, I'm not.
I'll hazard a guess at it, Elise. It's where you might be denied access to a computer.
Well, it's where basically what happens is a server, like a website or an email server, will have so many requests, it can't keep up with the requests. So it's like if you were standing in a crowded room, and you had all these people come up to you, "Hi, Leon, how are you going? Chat, 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 chat." And you had about 10 of them. You couldn't concentrate on any one person. You'd probably throw your hands up and go, "I give up." Well, that's what the server can do. This is what we're talking about. It's, say, a website like, you know, abc.net.au or microsoft.com or any of those sort of websites that you would normally visit. So it brings the website down. It actually happened to Twitter and Facebook several weeks back, and all the legitimate people who needed to access that site couldn't because the server, I guess you could say, was simply snowed under. You've got... Sorry, Leon.
Yeah, what I was going to say in the light of what you were just saying, now that you've explained that more clearly, I think what it says, and I think Kerry has said this too, or Geraldine, it's where the server gets too many requests, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly just it. Too many requests. Too many people going, "Hey, Leon, want to have a chat?" And you just go...
I have a good example of that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in this room in the morning, all sorts of people come in and everybody's talking. So if you're trying to set up for lecture, it's very hard to hear your computer. So your ears have denied service to that computer for the time being. And
well, I have to say that happened to me this morning with one particular person who visited me just as I was setting up. And it was very difficult.
It's just how it goes, but it's just my good example of that.
Scrolling down. Yeah, exactly. Spoofing gains access to resources on a network by claiming that it's a trusted computer. So we don't want a man in the middle attack intercepts traffic, and what does it do?
I know. What was it?
Go on, you tell us, Kerry, while I'm scrolling, because I'm sort of being a DDoS dust at the moment.
A man in the middle attack is where, say, for example, Bob and Alice are trying to communicate, because we always have Bob and Alice in security examples, and there is a man in the middle who is intercepting Bob's communications with Alice, and his name is Jim. So Bob sends a message that he thinks is going to Alice, but it's actually going to Jim. Jim then decrypts the message, checks the message out, modifies it, and sends it to Alice. Alice then sends her message back, who she thinks is sending it back to Bob. However, she's actually sending it back to Jim. Jim then runs it through the decrypts ring, and therefore Jim is able to get the information that is travelling between Bob and Alice and actually read what Bob and Alice are saying to each other. And I remember seeing a funny quote once that said that if Bob and Alice learnt a little bit about information security, the world would be a better place, because they seem to be the two people that have the most problem with information security in internet security books, because they're always called Bob and Alice.
Anyone have siblings? Ever tried to send a message to your parents or another sibling through another sibling, and it doesn't quite, they turn it around a little bit?
Chinese Whispers.
It's called Chinese Whispers, yes.
I actually have... I'm just thinking about... I'm a real Trekkie, Star Trek Voyager. There's an episode where they're being sent a hologram, but for some reason it went through and it got sent by the...
By the Ferengi, yes, I know that episode very well.
Yeah, very similar
that's
situation.
That's
an imagine.
Episode. Series 6, I think, actually, for all the Star Trek people out there. But yes, it was that's exactly what happened. The hologram got intercepted by the Ferengi, and it came through, and it was corrupted. But it did most of what it was supposed to do, and it did a little bit more. So there you go. They put a little Trojan in the hologram. So that wasn't cool.
Wasn't there another one where that happened with Data's nemesis? The guy from Sherlock Holmes, the evil dude from Sherlock Holmes, and he took control of the ship.
Oh, you're thinking of the Moriarty. Moriarty, yes. Ship in a Bottle. That was a Star Trek Next Generation episode, series 5 or 6. Let's just talk about Star Trek, guys. The Ship in a Bottle is the episode that Kerry's talking about. Jeez, I must get a life. I know the Star Trek's too well. Moriarty was the evil... Yes, Data's nemesis, because Data was the actual Sherlock Holmes. Anyway, back to the lecture. Where are we? Has anyone ever seen somebody lose their temper with a computer and smash it up with a hammer?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, people do.
Yeah, Chris Legg did that.
Oh, did?
I have not, but that would be interesting.
You've threatened to do so a few times, yep. Now, it doesn't sound as silly
I have
as
a song
seems.
About that.
We do, don't we? We do.
He didn't smash it with a window. If he had smashed it with a hammer, he threw it out the 7-story window. Yeah.
Yes. We might dig it up and play it after the lecture to the cavi people. The gates, it's called. Anyway, where are we? We smash up a computer with a hammer. Well, we don't always smash up a computer. We might feel like it. The next part of the notes discusses. If I can put my down, scrolling down.
It discusses how to destroy devices such as hard disks, which often contain sensitive data. Oh, so you just pick up whenever you're ready. I'm just talking until your screen stabilizes.
Okay, I'm here. Yeah, so basically that's what happens. We need to dispose of hard drives that may have information on them. Sure, we can reformat them, and we can write over them DDs and all sorts of things if we're Linux people. But really, essentially, there are men in spacesuits who can often get this information off. Now, it depends on how sophisticated your people out there who are trying to get your information are. But there are dumpster divers who go out there looking through rubbish dumps, looking for personal information, and they might find a hard drive that looks pretty good. They plug it in, and they might get information off it. So the disposal of computer components is very important. And that doesn't just go for hard drives. It also goes for optical media. We have seen bought, a friend of ours actually has one, a friend of Kerry's and mine, a shredder that will shred CDs. Didn't quite manage the Melbourne Trading Post, but it certainly shredded up CDs. And
I've got one too.
Yeah, and somebody shoves a whole heap of newspaper through it and it breaks. Credit cards is a very good, that's an excellent one, Mark, because people will often cut them up. You'll often go to a bank and surrender a credit card when you're getting a new one, and the staff will cut it up in front of you for that reason.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that one of the things, and I'm sure Jackie would know infinite amounts of this because she's actually studied the stuff, but in simple terms, often people will take a hard drive and they'll do a quick format under Windows. They just go, oh, quick format, and that'll take out the system areas, but all of the data is left behind. Often people will do a format of the hard drive which doesn't actually overwrite the data. It actually just verifies the sector's integrity and then just rewrites the system area so you can still pull all the data back off hard disks. And in fact, in a recent security attack, apparently you could steal encrypted data off people's netbooks if you were able to force the machine to reboot. The RAM would actually retain information for up to 15 seconds after the power was removed. So you could actually zap in there with a device and then pull all the clear text out of memory. It was an interesting security attack that said that RAM doesn't quite disappear as fast as you think it is. It certainly becomes more unreliable. But because hard disks work on magnetic fields, and we could have a whole lecture on this, but suffice it to say that you, every time you change the polarity of the magnetic fields, the polarity doesn't change to the same intensity. So what you can actually do is use a nuclear magnetic resonance scanner and actually detect the changes in the flux to actually retrieve up to 4 or 5 times what was on those sectors beforehand. So pretty amazing stuff. I think that their figures are about right. Depends on how good your NMR scanner is.
There are actually programs out there now that that can wipe the disks, the hard drive, and they do it to what they call Department of Defense specification standards. And they figure that if they wipe it with 3 entire passes of random numbers, that the data's toast.
Well, it helps.
I've heard that some of those programs are better than others, and you can get some, you know, Scrub and what's the other one? Shredder is another free one. TrueCrypt apparently has a secure erase option. Unfortunately, the people that own the nuclear magnetic resonance scanners won't usually tell us how good they are, so we're not really sure whether it is good enough to do it to the DoD standards or whether they
usually
still
on the free ones. Usually on the free ones, they don't go to DoD, and so you have to actually look at very closely at what the free ones offer.
Now, I think TrueCrypt actually does do it correctly, and I have seen a number of the ones in the years that I've actually inspected the source code, and they certainly do do the necessary transpositions and stuff. But yes, you do have to check it. The one that's freely downloadable from filehippo.com and is the top search result may not do the erase that you expect it will.
Yeah, it's certainly all very interesting sort of stuff. Are there any other comments before we go on to the next section? In the next part of the notes, we discuss security policies, or local security policies, which means an organisation, and we're all planning to get jobs in the big bad corporate sector, where you have certain ways of doing things to prevent your network from being compromised either electronically or physically. We have to think about, when we're in the corporate sector, what assets require protection, what type of protection. Do we just stick our server room, our main file server, in the middle of the office where people can walk in, or do we put in a proper room? What are the possible threats to our server or to our equipment? What do we do in the event of a security breach? So we need to also define, after that instance, a process for handling security breaches. Define a process to audit existing network security. Yes, go ahead, Jackie.
Sorry for interrupting, but just actually, I have found in my consulting work over the years that the corporations tend to have it somewhat together, not completely, but where I find the hugest lack of security is in small private facilities, medical offices. Senior centers,
absolutely,
that kind of thing. And it just is abominable. I mean, I go in there and I go, you know, what's your security policies? Or what?
Absolutely.
And they need it every bit as much as the corporation does. I have seen horrible things happen. One employee got fired, and the next thing he knew, the whole senior center was brought down because she got in and remotely deleted all the accounts.
Yeah, and this is another thing, too. A disgruntled employee, whether they're fired or still working, can get in and do all sorts of things. So keep your employees happy. Okay.
And that was why, a few years ago, when they started to make people redundant in the banking industry, they used to actually escort them back to their desk, get them to clean out their desk, and escort them out the building so that they couldn't interfere.
They do that in a lot of places, yep.
One of the problems is if you're cagey and clever, you'll have inserted about 6 back doors into their systems about 4 months before this has happened. So even when they do march you out of the building, you've still got 4 of them left that you can still get in and take the data down big time. Or you know the systems well enough to be able to know which remote access lines are going to let you in and what sort of things they're going to allow you to do. It's a very difficult thing to keep a system completely secure, because often you do have there are times when you do need to give trust to your employees, and that then again lowers your security based on. So you've always got those diametrically opposing security views.
Some
I don't know what was in that vanilla
line,
milkshake, but gee, I've got some stuff to say this morning.
He didn't give me
just
one.
My wonderful present.
Maybe you're just getting. Thanks, Jerky. She just said, "What's new?" Maybe you're just getting the psychic waves
from my vanilla
milkshake. Yeah, it was Jenny. Sorry.
I thought it was my wonderful present. Okay, so we need to define a process for handling network security instances. Yeah, take your computer off the internet, bury it, and never talk to it again. Define a process to audit your network security. So sort of sit down in meetings and plan, and keep planning, and then wonder what you've done. In other words, have a talk fest. Here's a good one. Define behaviours that are allowed. Do we let our people in the corporate sector get on Facebook? Or do we let them come in with a memory stick and put on their favourite little program or play games? Apart from the fact it's a time waster, the amount of viruses that are getting around on memory sticks, and I'm sure Kerry's going to say something here about the tax office, there are a lot of government departments and things that do not allow people to bring in, flash drives and that sort of thing, because they don't know what's on them. Plus, we've got the problem is going back the other way. People can steal information and copy it on there. Did somebody wish to speak?
I was just going to say, you've already... Go ahead, Jackie.
When I was working for a corporation back in 95, the president of the corporation brought in a floppy with a virus called Monkey, and it was a boot sector virus. And she brought down the whole company.
And so even back in 1995... some 14 years ago we had this problem. Not many people were aware of it, but, these days the flash drives are so more popular. But, yeah, I remember people bringing in... I remember people bringing in all sorts of things back in the early to mid-90s and installing all sorts of programs they ought not to be installing on, companies' computers and all sorts of things. Kerry, did you have something to say?
You've taken my tax office story, but it just so happens I've got about six more. And one of those is that... we've had the boot sector viruses from things like the stoned virus, if anybody remembers the stone virus, which was one of the very first boot sector viruses. And you also have people who, one of the other dangers you've got to be careful of is a lot of these portable apps that you're seeing. It's your copy of Firefox that can run even if you don't have administrator access. And you've got to sort of ask yourself, and in fact some companies actually stop you from launching applications from flash drives, which upsets the employees mightily. I actually sort of made noises about restricting Facebook at the association here, but people sort of jumped up and down so hard that we didn't actually do it in the training area. But we OpenDNS would allow that to happen if we felt the urge to do so.
Well, I think the thing is, it's gonna get to a point with, say, Facebook and YouTube, but definitely Facebook and Twitter, where that some corporations or some employees will actually legitimately need access to them, because they're posting information. Now, some of it's done from automated systems. We see the ABC posting all sorts of things on all over Twitter that are done automatically. But there are times where people will genuinely need to get on a social networking website to discuss what the business is doing. So, you'll probably find that eventually employers will have, instead of, permissions to get to certain shares, do you have Facebook permission? No. Okay. So, it'll be interesting to see how social networking sort of gets into the business sector, as it already has.
Although people have actually lost their jobs over it, because there was one guy who actually rang his boss and pulled a sickie and said that he was sick at work, and he wasn't coming into work. And then the idiot, 5 minutes later, fired up Facebook and posted a status message going, "Taking a sick day, lounging at home with a few beers, watching the footy."
What an idiot!
What a deal! Like. If you're that stupid, then do
you
it.
Probably deserve get it.
You deserve it. Sorry, mate. You deserve it, mate. That's terrible.
I bet that went down well with the boss.
Oh, he probably got the sack. He got fired. Yes, it went down very well with the boss. He was replaced in a week. Okay, define behaviours that are prohibited. We've just done that. Define what to log and how to store your logs. This is for the network administrator people, because network administrator people like to know who's logging onto the network, when they're logging onto the network, and for how long that they're there. Okay, define access to network resources through account permissions. This gets back to just, do we have Facebook permissions on this account? You know, I've worked in many corporate environments where, you know, the help desk staff have a certain level of access, the people over in systems have a certain level of access, the people in accounts have different levels of access, and we talk more about this in the discovery courses where we talk about dividing up a company into little networks or subnets. So we need to do this so that, you know, privacy is maintained, and that the accounts people have got the access they need to accounts, but they may not have access to, coding and stuff where they can wipe in and, you know, take out, you know, 3 weeks worth of programming that a programmer's just about ready to deploy and cause a lot of angst that way. So, yeah, we do need to consider what access is given to our employees. Define authentication technologies, and this is an interesting point. We talk about passwords, and we might spend a bit of time on this point. What makes a good password? Other authentication techniques, biometrics. Does anyone know what biometrics is? It's a nice big word for you out there, guys.
Go,
Mark.
I was just going to say, isn't that like the scanner that reads your, what exactly does it read, the DNA or the
you may, if you want, and I think Jackie also had something to say. Go ahead anyway, Jenny.
The scanners that read fingerprints and iris prints, isn't it?
Retinas.
The word is actually derived from two. Bio to mean life, and metric to mean measure. And so, it's any kind of device that can read something off of a person that's uniquely identifiable, such as fingerprints, retinas, external ears, believe it or not, the external ear has a unique pattern. Mm. Voice has a unique pattern. So any uniquely identifiable pattern that a person possesses as a result of his being the person that he or she is.
That's right. So it's a biometric scanner, and we see them cropping up on laptops now. I've never used one, I have to be honest. But they do occur.
You can get external USB ones too.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
Anyone seen the movie Angels and Demons? I read the book. They talk very heavily about, yes, oh well. Yes, me, somebody says. They talk very heavily in the early part of that book about biometrics and about the eye. And they only needed the eye, didn't they? They did, yes. They removed the poor guy's eye so they could get through the scanner. Smart cards. That is another instance. We have smart cards.
You see a bunch of those in hotels, don't you? Because they key you do. The room keys.
You do.
Yeah, you walk in, and those smart cards can be replaced if they get lost, so they cancel the number, or they can deny you access. And look, I worked in a corporate building about 12 years ago that even had them. And you swipe the card, and you'd have a little card that you just swiped over near the sensor. Back in those days, people were a little bit more cavalier, and, oh, can I come through with you? No worries. And, yeah, people would be letting people funny about that. They'd probably still do it.
We had them in NASA, and actually ours would let you into certain floors, and only your card was only programmed for certain doors and everything. It was pretty secure.
That's
cool.
Right.
My husband worked in the banking industry, and you don't know what security is until you work in a bank.
Yeah, they only give you access to certain parts of the building, that some manager has deemed you allowed to go, and that's that. So don't have access. Certain hours, that's a good one. They can lock you out at a certain time. We can also do that at electronic level on networks too. I can't remember what I worked at when I was a Premier in Cabinet. They did that. They shut down the network access for remote people or from even people inside the building to be logged on between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. or some such thing.
They did that at our school for the blind, so we can be on the computer late night. But the thing was, if you had your computer on, you still had network access, and you just left whatever it was open, and you could use it all night.
They've probably got some way around that now, too. Physical security. It's as important as Physical security is as important as data security. So we all have this room is the Triple E Club, or the Netbook Club. There's desktop PCs, and I think only one of them has been used. We all have PCs that we take home with us, which is all really good here in WA. But I put a password on mine. Okay, sure, someone could take the hard drive out and probably even get around the Windows password pretty quickly, but it will stop some people.
You could put a hard disk password on it in the BIOS, and in fact the EEPC supports that, and if you do that, and somebody does take the hard drive out, it won't do them any good.
Well, that's handy. Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, maybe we could. A discussion for another day. But basically, I've got all the Lonsdale Media and Toastmaster stuff on here and Cavi stuff on here and all that sort of stuff. There's some information extra I brought across to Perth, so that I wouldn't normally have on this PC. So data security or physical security of my Triple E PC, and I'm sure everyone else's in this room, is important. I have a removable hard drive at home on the server, which is now over at my next door neighbour's. Can somebody tell me, or over the road actually, but why have I bothered taking my backup drive off my main Linux machine at home and sent it over the road for the week that I'm in Perth? Anyone got some ideas?
I know.
For security?
It's a very broad answer, Leon, but go ahead, Jenny.
If anything happens to your house, if it's burgled or your house burns down, you've got your backup in another place.
Correct. Remote backups. Yeah, look, that's another technique. We could actually have we probably will set that up. I would like to do that and just send some information across the net to a place. There are people out there who are, who pay services to back up your data, and you can leave these backups running overnight. So it is an off-site backup. But yeah, I've got it more at a more basic level, that I just physically picked the drive up and took it over to Wheelane's place on Thursday night before I came. And that way, as Jenny said, if the house burns down, okay, I might lose my server, and that wouldn't be cool, but I wouldn't lose the data. The server can be replaced.
There's an incredible amount of online services that do the remote data backup, and they've got all sorts of backup stuff, and some of it's like, $2 a gig or whatever, or Amazon's got one. I think Christopher Toff found a really good one that he mentioned a couple of months back that was insanely cheap.
They're becoming cheaper. I looked at one about 2 or 3 years ago, and I think he wanted $50 or $60 a month for a gig. I would say it's considerably cheaper now. It was sort of a novel thing in Australia back 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah, that's just this. What Kieran's saying is that I'm not sure that he's coming through on the voice system, but he's saying they're a lot cheaper. You're not on it. So what was it you're saying there? What was the price you were saying, Kieran? Free 2 gig thing? Mm. Yeah. 150 gig for $5 a what month? Yeah, now, so that's considerably cheaper than what I just said. And you would need to know that it's fast. You would also need to know that it's doing a backup that's like an incremental backup or something. You're not just going to back up your whole data in every hit. You're only going to back up the files that are cheap.
The other thing is with... I would say with low upload speeds on ADSL, it can make that a bit untenable, because it's going to take you a long time, longer to push the data up than it is to pull the data down. And as of course Elise will be aware of, and Grace has just mentioned on chat to me, both Elise, Will and I use a program called rsync, which is specifically good at keeping large trees of files in sync with each other.
Rsync is what I use to get all that information onto my removable storage. And because I only backed up the files that had changed that week, or that whenever between the last ones. So rsync for Linux people, well, I now believe for Windows, but I never quite got it working, is available.
Yeah, there is also a thing called the Microsoft Sync Toy, which is part of the Power Toys. And I would strongly recommend that anybody running Windows Vista or later will already have RoboCopy. It is magic stuff. wonderful utility Robocopy. If you don't have Windows Vista or later, you can actually download the Windows 2003 Server Resource Kit tools, which will work under any version of Windows from 2000 upwards, and that also contains Robocopy. And if you have one utility on your computer for copying files on and off removable drives and stuff, and you want it for free and you want it to work, then Robocopy is the utility you want. It's absolute magic. And you know, you can go and pay, you know, $49 for SyncBack Pro or $29 for Megafile Sync Pro or whatever, but there are some really good free utilities out there that do everything that the commercial ones do. There is actually one called Free File Sync that's up on SourceForge, but unfortunately it's inaccessible. I intend to open a dialogue with the author to see if I can get that changed, because who knows, we might actually get accessibility to Free File Sync, and it's just as good as, it's GUI and just as good as all the other ones. GUI in a good way.
GUI in a good way. You going to sing a song about that, Geraldine?
I prefer she, we should prefer she didn't, don't we?
Bah! Okay. Any further discussions, points of interest before we move on to the next bit I've got highlighted here in green?
The only other thing I would say about that is you want to make sure that the online backup service is, you know, well encrypted, because you don't want just everybody looking at your stuff.
Yeah, this is just it, and not just encrypted once it's there, but encrypted on the way there. I'm not sure what protocols these things use, but whatever. Yeah, exactly. They probably have some neat little piece of software you install and sort of makes it easy for the user.
Also, make sure that any of the data that you are installing on these file sharing services that you're backing up is data that you legally own. Of course, that goes without saying. Nobody has data that they may have acquired through illegal methods, because nobody does that. But if you are one of the few people in the world, in fact, 98% of PC users are pirates, those services can actually be audited. And if they can link it back to you, you can get yourself into quite a serious amount of trouble.
Like I was about to say, what planet did you walk on? Next part of the lecture talks about passwords. And passwords are very important, because they're the main sort of, and your main point of authenticating. And passwords should contain a mixture of letters and numbers so that they're not easily cracked. Broken, says the text I have in front of me. Yes, broken. Password standards should prevent people from writing them down and leaving them up to be sort of, you know, looked at. So you don't want to have them in public view. There should be rules about password expiration and when the passwords are changed. There should also be rules on your policy on what happens if unsuccessful attempts or several unsuccessful attempts are made to gain access to your resources. Will the account lock after maybe three or five unsuccessful attempts? So, will your computer blow up? Will the world end? But the thing is, you have to lock out the account so that it appears that the person who's infiltrating it, if it's somebody who shouldn't be, it just always continuously gets asked for the password and doesn't know why they're not getting on. There have been several systems I've been involved with where that hasn't happened, and eventually brute force has happened and they've cracked the password and they've gotten in, which is not good.
One of the things to keep in mind, and this is...
Go ahead, Mark.
I was just going to say on MySpace, they have a thing if you type in your password wrong, like I think it's like twice or something like that, then they lock you out and you have to basically reset your password and you have to go through a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, look, we used to have this in the corporate sector where a person would ask for a password reset, and this is going back even 10 years. I don't know what it would be like now. And they had to fill in a form and get their manager to sign the form before the help desk, a la myself and my colleagues, were actually allowed to reset the password. We couldn't just have people ringing us up going, I've forgotten the password. Okay, we'll reset it. Bingo, off you go. We had to make sure that there was some accountability, so that if the password were to be reset and it was a problem, that we could at least have some sort of form of tracking. Yeah, it would also be logged in the help desk system as well, that the person's asked for a password reset.
I was going to say, one of the reasons biometrics has become so popular is because even with letters and numbers and the increasing speed of computers, passwords that contain English words, even if they do contain letters and numbers, the crack dictionaries have got things for adding numbers on it, and they've got upper casing, and they've got upper lower casing, and they've got transposition rules and that sort of thing. So the biometrics are becoming popular because passwords just don't have enough entropy to provide reasonable security these days. And people forget them. If your password's like MKU capital Z69P.79 tilde, you're not going to remember that unless you're a particularly unusual individual, and you won't be able to log back in. So, of course, the first thing you do is you write it on a piece of paper, or you write it into your Braille display. Yes, all you blindies think you're clever with your Braille displays, but we can all read them. In fact, most of the blind community owns your passwords. Yeah, as long as the kids can't read it.
Kids can't. Actually, Jackie and I were just talking about this the other day. Kerry put me onto it originally, so thank you, Kerry. It's a program called KeePass. And you put your password, you basically have a master password to this program. And you only have to remember one master password. It has fields for a descriptive name, an arbitrary name. It has a field for a URL if you're going to a particular website where you need to log on. And it has a field for obviously the username and the password and some notes. Now, what it does also very well is it will generate you a password. It's usually something like 20 characters long. You can go into the options screen and define the amount of characters. You can also tell it whether you want the generated passwords to have, colons, semicolons, punctuation, letters, uppercase, lowercase, all the rest of the sort of parameters you might think about. And it will generate your password. Or you have the option of just typing your own one in. So if you're setting it up, which I did, I went through all my notes and put all my things in I already had passwords for. I just had to overwrite it and key in the password I wanted. And when you can either go into the record and copy and paste it, or you can simply right-click on the record and basically go down the context menu to copy password, copy username. I'll tab back to the respective thing you're logging into, do your Control-V, and away you go.
There's also plugins for web browsers as well, which will actually automatically do that for you without you even having to do it yourself. Once you've authenticated with KeePass, it'll go, oh, you're on myfavoritewasteoftime.com. Would you like to auto-log in? And it will actually do it for you.
Yeah, I must play with the plugins. I just haven't bothered. It's free. Keepass.com. I don't think.
No, it's keepass.info. KEEPASS. KeepPass. But it's. I thought it was KEY, but it's keep AWS. I think. Google for KEYPASS, and you'll actually get the URL up. Hang on.
You guys can Google it.
Do it, sir.
Oh, you do that. I was just going to look at it here. Because I actually have it on Triple E PC. And it's also one of those neat little programs that if you have it on your desktop machine at home, or you have it on your file server like I do, which means it gets backed up with the rsync scripts I've got, what happens is you can just copy it off the computer and put it on your Triple E. You don't have to mess around with installing it and patching the registry and all that sort of rubbish. So it's very portable. It's on here. I bought all my... one of the things I did when I checked for the information I wanted to bring to Perth last Thursday was I actually made sure I copied the KeePass directory just basically overwrote it. There was one already there with an out-of-date version of the database. And away you go.
So we basically have to torture you to get your master password and then we're right.
Yep.
You're correct, yes. Torture me, get the master password and you've got an epic success.
So it's www.keepass.info. I'd say they weren't allowed to use KEYPASS because somebody's probably trademarked it, so it's keep AWS. So, there's an interesting
which
concept.
Which is pretty good. Keep pass.
Yeah, I always keep pass behind myself as well.
Okay, virtual private...
Oh, I know about these virtual private networks.
Let's have a look at what the notes say. Because I must admit, I'm on holidays and I didn't get the chance to go right through the entire set of notes, etc. I'm so slack, aren't I? Yes, it's much nicer to be wading around in a pond in a nice summer's day than be doing computery stuff, I can tell you. In the bus and stuff. Virtual private networks allow users encryption to protect data. allows a user to safely access resources, wow, without being physically attached to the local network. That's all it says. Okay.
That's database. Really dismal.
Do you want to elaborate, Kerry?
Yeah, briefly.
Do you want to elaborate, Kerry?
Yeah.
Go off.
Well, thank you, Jenny. I'll remember that. Essentially, virtual private networks are networks between two generally geographically separated locations that channel their data over the internet in encrypted form so that the actual payload is encrypted. That's the security thing we call payload. We use these really funky terms. A bit like payloads, like also what's in the rocket or what you send to the moon or lots of other things that we
what's
don't need to talk
about. What's on the end of the missile?
Yeah, on the end of a missile, that's right. And essentially what you do is you can set up these VPNs, and there are certain ones such as Hamachi. Don't use the free Hamachi VPN because it's really dangerous and people
such
can bust into your computer. Well, she probably had the Windows firewall turned off, which wouldn't help either. And the other thing you can do is, I use one called OpenVPN, www.openvpn.net. It's free. It rocks. I love it. I will have its little VPNs if I possibly could. I use it so that I can get my email from home, and I have my servers at home which I OpenVPN into, and my mail is not only encrypted, but it's also compressed over the OpenVPN link, which means I have very fast access to my home mail at work, and you can connect into your VPN and get access to stuff at home. So, excellent bit of kit. Little bit tricky to set up initially, but hey, what doesn't have a learning curve?
That all sounds very interesting. And I assume you're... any network shares that can come up in my computer and all that sort of stuff on your
Samba's pretty bad over dial-up links, and I don't recommend using Samba over the internet. It's not suited for that sort of transfer, but yes, it does work slowly. But Samba is not designed, or SMB is not designed as SMB. Low bandwidth sort of protocol. You want sort of high bandwidth. I usually use WinSCP for shoveling things backwards and forwards, generally speaking.
I was about to say, yeah. What if people were out there doing this from... Kerry's doing it from a Linux machine, which is why he's talking Samba. But if people were doing it from Windows machines, whether you could use the normal...
Certainly can, and it certainly does work. And OpenVPN exists for Linux, it exists for Windows, it exists for the Mac, and it also exists for a lot of the little embedded routers like OpenWRT and stuff, which is pretty snazzy. You can actually get your little wireless router to be encrypting your wireless traffic with VPN. So what you do, and I intend to do this at some point, I'm going to have a wide-open wireless network, and it's going to have no encryption on it whatsoever. But the problem is you're going to have to connect to OpenVPN to get into it. So all those people can associate it, and they can have that little feeling of happiness, which can then turn to despair once they realise they can go nowhere and get at nothing. So that's my little hit back at all these little wireless network thieves.
So you let them authenticate onto your access point, but that's as far as they get.
That's right, and then they can open, if you've got the keys, they can open the VPN connection, shovel the encrypted traffic over the network, get access to the full internet, but if you don't, you'll just get access to an access point that might actually throw up a nasty web page with a message that sort of says, go away, you're not wanted.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so you let them get that far. Okay. File system security. Is there any other... any other comment from the masses before we go on to the file system security? Is there anybody out? Is there anybody out there? We're all here.
Just sitting here.
We're all here.
Me neither.
I'm still here.
Oh, that's good. It's not lunchtime. It's not lunchtime in the sunshine state yet. Oh, that's good.
Okay. Good morning, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
Daylight savings has bitten.
I DM'd it.
Hi, Amanda. Okay, we've discussed data backups. I think last week we probably did actually discuss access points. I'm pretty sure we did. So we discussed why we actually make sure our backups and things go off-site.
Hang on, we just missed out on file system security. You were sort of...
I think that's next.
All right.
File system security. There you go, Kerry. Funny about that. I knew it was coming. All file systems keep track of resources, but only file systems with journals can log access by user date and time.
That's cool. Don't worry about it.
No problem.
Okay, it's talking about figure three here. I don't have figure three in front of me, so I don't know what they're talking about. But I think they're talking about something that lacks journaling, probably fat food. So if you're using a file system such as FAT32 or something, you will have less security. You'll have less ability to know who owns each file. Usually on NTFS and the Linux file systems, you can look at the permissions, or you can look at the file attributes and see who the owner or the group or the owner of that file is. So there's files on the system that ought not to be there. You can at least work back through and say, well, this was brought on here by Kerry. What's this file doing here? Oh, okay. Has Kerry put those files there, or has his account been compromised and somebody's done it for him?
Just a point here, most journaling file systems only journal metadata, so they only journal things like the inodes and the actual file names and stuff. They don't actually journal data. You can actually journal data, but to journal data is a very expensive operation, because you actually have to write the data into the journal and then copy it back out to the file system. So what a lot of people are doing these days is they're actually using solid state disks to hold the journal and then putting it out onto spinning storage once you commit the journal out to spinning storage. So, yeah, anyway.
So there are tests, there are questions in your tests. Not sure offhand which module, might even be this one, but it's, that do discuss and do ask you questions about journaling. So be aware of those, guys.
Bookmark 947,804 inserted. Victor Stream Overflow.
To read it. I saw an NLS player yesterday for the first time. Well, okay, so it's interesting to be aware of these different types of file systems, not just by name, but also why you would use them. And there's a lot of talk about NTFS that goes on in the ITE1 course, and if you're doing ITE2, you'll have no doubt heard of file systems like EXT3. EXT4 for Linux is just it's been around for a little while now, a short time now.
It's in the new Ubuntu. RFS.
It is, yes, and it's been supported by FC, whatever the latest version of FC is, 12 as of this month, yep.
Just a point to say that Microsoft has a new encryption technology in Windows 7, just because we're all Windows 7 happy at the moment, called BitLocker. And apparently if you're running the ultimate versions of the ultimate mega, I've got too much money and I think I need those six extra features version of Windows 7, you can use BitLocker. I would warn you, however, that BitLocker is a proprietary technology and nobody understands really how it works, so if it breaks, you seriously do get to keep both pieces. So just be aware of that and be careful what you BitLocker, because you might not get it out.
Oh well, somebody will crack it in 3 years' time anyway, like they do with everything else. So, I'm just scrolling. Okay, so it's basically we're just talking about the NTFS. Okay, it also mentions here in the notes you can upgrade, and I know it was one of the labs too about this time in the course, you can actually upgrade from FAT32 to NTFS using the Windows Conversion Utility, so you get a better, you get the security tab when you go and look at the properties on a tree structure. It's not reversible, so once you've made the decision, if you've got a working machine to go NTFS and you want to go back to FAT32, rebuild your machine.
Actually, it is reversible with Partition Magic's utilities. If you happen to own PowerCurse Partition Magic, yes, the notes don't actually cover that, but Partition Magic does have a back convert. However, one of the things about a back convert you should realise is that from going from NTFS to FAT32, you lose all the security descriptors, and that's not often something you want to do, so it's something you should very carefully think about. A mutual friend of Elisa's and mine agonised about whether he was going to convert from FAT32 to NTFS, and
he did, didn't he?
And it turned out the thing that finally pushed him over the edge was he tried to copy a DVD, and you cannot store a 4GB file on a FAT32 file system, and Nero dropped its bundle, and that was that. He finally went to NTFS.
he fought it for years, didn't he, Kerry? I'm not going to do NTFS. And now he just has fallen in love with the security tab.
He has, and he has a copy of Cackles all ready to go and a copy of Unlocker to blast any files that might decide they don't want to be deleted. For those of you who don't know, Unlocker is a utility that will unlock a file from the operating system. So when Windows says cannot delete file or folder, just run Unlocker on it, and it is infinitely smashable. You can delete it at possibly the cost of your the stability of your computer. So be warned, don't use Unlocker unless you know exactly what you're doing.
Okay. We're talking about Wi-Fi here. Wireless transport layer. Hang on. What? WTLS. WTLS? Hang on. Wireless transport layer security. Okay. Wireless devices do not have a great deal of bandwidth to devote to security protocols. But there is WPA and other security methods around that we actually talk about in Discovery as to how to secure our wireless networks and the sort of procedures that go on when we're going to authenticate onto an access point to get wireless networking. Now, I will need to just do a bit of scrolling and look at my real notes, because these are the notes I made last week. I've got to the end of them. How about that? But I need to know that we are at the end of them for sure. So while I'm doing that, is there any comments from the group on any of the things that we've discussed, or any questions?
Just want to say you're doing well.
Thank you. Thank you, Grace. Mark, do you have anything to say? Jackie?
You survived this.
Survived, yeah. I got through the first lecture. Well, I may have got through the first lecture. I'm just going through the official curriculum, because these are the notes I made.
You know, one thing I guess maybe I should bring up here at this point is a concept called alternate data streams.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we've had a bit of a wrangle with that about 2 years ago. Okay, go off, Jackie. Off you go.
This is something that's completely unique to the NTFS file system. And in certain respects, I mean, they can be a good thing. Oftentimes, your metadata, for example, in Microsoft Word, can be contained in alternate data streams. However, sometimes they are bad things. All kinds of malware, etc., can be hidden in these. And your average antivirus type of software does not pick it up. There are special programs that do, but your average basic, you know, AVG, Avast, that kind of thing really does not do a good job of picking them up. So, you know, there is a certain amount of security that comes with NTFS, but alternate data streams are definitely one of the risks.
One of the interesting things about data streams, and I think they did actually get implemented in things like XFS and RICERFS has a namespace. RICER 4 has an alternate namespace that you can store stream data in. The interesting thing about data streams is they're one of these features that sort of made it into the operating system, and you can have, you know, three or four or five different streams for different files, and there are little articles on the net that will show you how to write data into the alternate data streams from the command prompt for various files. But they're one of those sort of features that made it into the operating system, and not many people even know they even exist. You think that, you know, explosion.doc is just explosion.doc. You don't realize that there are six other data streams that have got an MP3 file, a picture, a virus, a Trojan, and a partridge in a pear tree. And it's interesting how just nobody knows about data streams, really. I mean, a few people do, but they're just, who's ever heard of a data stream? It's bizarre.
In fact... a lot of the malware that comes through the P2P systems is done in just that way. You think you're getting an MP3 file, and guess what?
Yeah, we thought we were looking at it about 2 years ago. Will and I were trying to track down this virus, and we were just interested to know that we suspected, I don't think we proved it, that there was probably more than one data stream there.
And, yeah, there are programs that you can get. One of them is called LADS, and there are others that are freeware that can help you detect those. But I just thought I'd bring it up since we were talking about security in the NTFS file system.
Yep. Well, it's good that we did. And guess what, guys? We actually haven't got to the official end of the lecture. I found some more in the real notes. Ooh. So, if there's any more discussion to be done on file system security, we can keep doing it for a bit, or we can move on to the next.
I say we move on.
bit much for you, is it, Mark? No, but it's something to be aware of, because as both Kerry and Jackie have said, not too many people know about these things. And you may not have to know exactly how it works, but at least something to be aware of, because if you see a nice little Word document or you see your MP3 file, it's not just the MP3 file. It may not be just the MP3 file. The wireless, back to the wireless security techniques. We've got wired equivalent privacy, which was the first of the encryption methods, where we actually were able to encrypt our data over the network, and guess what? It got hacked, and that's not very good. So they went through to... the hackers quickly discovered that 64-bit encryption was pretty easy.
That wasn't actually the problem. No, it was actually the fact that there was the initialization vector for the encryption packets was actually the same across the entire stream. So all you had to do was do a known plain text attack by looking for MAC addresses that you knew where they showed up in the packets, and then just figure out what the initialization vector was, and then you had the whole stream unlocked. So it wasn't actually the key size that was the problem. You don't actually brute force the key. You just actually brute force the IVs, and that gets you into the web stream. So a web crack is... I think there's a joke gone in 60 seconds, and that's web.
Fair enough. A lot of, it says here in the notes, an attempt to overcome this week, most users employ 128-bit key, so, there's... Go ahead, Jackie.
But the WPA is dynamic, actually. And
it,
so
WPA
is
dynamic,
yeah.
It can be, but it doesn't have to be. And this is interesting. Be careful how you set your WPA up, because if you don't set up temporal key integrity, it's not dynamic. And yes, we have cracks for WPA too. They use a nice big dictionary and a fast computer and a copy of GRML and AirCrack. So, be aware of there are ways around WPA too. Be careful with how you set your passwords, because a weak password will still be your undoing on WPA and WPA too. Obviously, somebody like Jackie or Elise or any of us won't have a problem, but there are people who set their password to cat or dog, and their networks are pretty easy to break into.
That's right. And all of these things, if people try hard enough, someone's going to get you. But you'll lock out the majority of people and that sort of thing. Another way of protecting your wireless network, of course, is to switch off your SSID. Whilst that won't... There are ways around this, and I'm sure Kerry will have something to say in a minute. At least if the network's not discoverable right away, it might just keep some people away from even trying to look for it. But yes, so if you do switch off the SSID, you do have to know what the SSID of the network is you want to authenticate to. Rather than just doing a scan for available networks in your Windows dialog box, you have to know what the name is. And once you have it exposed, you can light it up or something, can't you, Kerry? The network.
You can. Things like Kismet will show you cloaked networks if there's traffic between the access point and any of the other stations. I read somewhere also, and Jackie's correct, that the keys are actually changeable on a regular basis. Apparently WPA is pretty useless as far as security. They thought they'd actually fixed the security weakness, but apparently to actually be really safe, you really want WPA too, because apparently the WPA networks are now vulnerable as well. There are also attacks for WPA too, but they're not quite as efficient as the ones for WEP and WPA. So I think the actual Cisco recommendations, having doing discovery, is you should utilize hidden ESSID, WPA2 with a good set of changing keys, and MAC address filtering, and you should have all three on your network.
Yeah, look, a lot of people don't, but go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to bring up the fact that, you know, basically here's what it comes down to. I think it's very much like locking up the windows and doors on your house, or putting a club and locking the door on your car. The more work it's going to take to break into a network, the less attractive it is to people. You know, these guys want to get in and get out. Some of them, are, of course, are interested in you know, doing the big stuff, but most of these people are just interested in getting in and out and getting whatever data they can. And if you make them truly work for it, they're probably not going to want to do it.
Look on to the next person who's easier.
Yeah, we run WEP at home because there's a couple of PDAs that don't support WPA because of Windows Mobile 5. And seriously, we've never had a security incursion on the network. The keys have been the same for a very long time. And it is a case of effort. We do know of somebody, however, though, that does have a quite a powerful laptop they take with them, and they actually have a seven-element Yagi folded up in their backpack, and they honestly get their internet access on holidays by setting up the Yagi and pointing it out the hotel window. So there are some interesting people out there.
A Yagi
but I would imagine that the people they get their
antenna.
I would imagine most of those people, though, get their... I mean, I would imagine that it's from an open wireless network.
Yeah, well, exactly. They're just looking around for an open wireless network. Off they go.
Yeah, about 10Ks away, usually. this person's actually a Cisco person, and he does actually pack these up and take them with him. But there are actually things like GRML. The new 2009.10 has just come out. We've had a very exciting month this month. We've had Ubuntu come out, we've had a new Fedora, and we've had a new GRML, so I'm personally very happy. And it's actually got a lot of the cracking tools and stuff on it, so if you want to play with wireless cracking and air crack and snort and all those sorts of things, for your own personal educational use, of course, they're on there.
Speaking of Ubuntu, I actually have a disk that I tried loading, you know, like booting it from the RAM and whatever, and my computer apparently is not powerful enough to run it, so whatever, but I got my puppy Linux to play around with anyway, so yeah.
We don't cover that in this particular set of lectures. I'm sure some of us can talk to you off Ventrilo about that. I think your machine, if it can run Windows, it will run Ubuntu. There will be another reason why that's not coming up, but we won't talk about that quite here. Do make sure that if you are going to play with Ubuntu, though, do get the latest Ubuntu 9.1. And also know that there's another one called Damn Small Linux. If your computer is really underpowered, that's probably the one you want. So we can talk to you about that at some other point. But, definitely glad that you're taking a look at the alternate operating systems.
Yes, it's definitely very good. Okay, the next part of the notes talks about changing the... Oh, MAC filtering, yeah. We've covered pretty much the wireless section. So MAC filtering, change the default password, buy a new access point. How many people around the suburbs have got D-Link and MECOM and... even Telstra Big Pond, where there are a few wireless networks I've seen around my area. I now have about three wireless networks around where I live now. And they all, some of which have interesting names, like Netcom and just whatever the default name happens to be of the access point, because just people get them, plug them in, plug them into the internet, switch them on, and away they go.
Interesting story about that, actually. We actually had somebody in Melbourne who'd set up their internet, and then their internet had stopped working or something, and their internet had stopped working, and it had broke. And they actually went in, and they went and they upgraded the firmware on this router, and they went and reset all the passwords, and they reset all the SSIDs and everything. And then they discovered that their router had actually blown up, and the one that they were actually doing maintenance on was their next door neighbour's router. And they actually went down and said, well, your router's just got a firmware upgrade, and it just so happens that your internet's broken because we've been using your internet for a week, and we're terribly sorry that we've done this. How can we make it up to you? And those people were just sort of like, well, we know you. They're just losing it, just going, well, that's wireless for you.
Well, they got a free firmware upgrade and reconfigured and all that. So
they got their ISR reconfigured free of charge. Oh, that's incredible, that one. Firewall, put a firewall on if you want. Be careful that you know what you're doing. Yes, update to the latest available firmware. Well, these neighbours next door to these people certainly got that. So, make sure you've got you know, if you are having difficulties, make sure you've got a known good the firmware installed. And you can install or activate a firewall. Now, this can be done on your ISR, which is your integrated services router. In other words, the box you plug in the phone line. And basically, you can also have firewalls on your computer. And we've probably had many, many discussions over, Kathy, on personal firewalls on your computer. Norton anti-internet, or anything anti-internet. Kerry tells a story about somebody here who was trying to access a lot of network resources and didn't know there was a firewall running on the computer that blocked just about everything. So be careful with the firewalls that you can buy off the shelf, because they are made for the consumer, and it's basically sometimes if you're not sure what you're doing, one button stops all.
Actually, Dean, he'll put his hand up for this. When he first started with us, he was just about tearing his hair out, because no matter what he would do, it would not load the Cisco.netacad site. And he'd tried everything, and this was when he'd first gotten started with it, and he was petrified of being labelled as a bad student. And we ended up chasing this down. Ian spent about 6 hours on the phone with him, and they finally uninstalled Norton Anti-Internet, as we call it, and bang, everything just worked. Wham! And he's vowed never to install Norton on the computer that he uses for the Cisco network.
I think everybody's had some experience like that with Norton and vowed never to do it again.
In fact, 2003 onwards.
One of our current students had a very similar difficulty, and I worked with this particular student, and we got it remedied, but... Yeah, there was a security suite on the computer that was barring access to Ventrilo. So
okay, it's without mentioning names. Oh no, that's I'm thinking of the music group. You had a funny. But I've seen that happen before. Plenty of things, and just the odd things stop. You'd have to go through a plethora of dialog boxes to work out why. I just don't install them. But there again, I'm okay if I do get something on my computer. I do actually run another product which. He's reasonably well behaved, but it is something.
I remember that, by the way, Jackie.
Well, okay, Mark, if you're going to step up to the plate and volunteer the information, but
we're going to leave you anonymous, Mark.
Put yourself in it, Mark. Could have left you anonymous,
that's
old son.
Right, though. I don't care. Talk about me. At least I'm here to hear it.
Well, it's a good war story. So there you go. We've had two cases of students being denied access to the Cisco and our learning tools because of rogue firewalls. Three.
Yeah, there's another one that actually he got an OEM build of his operating system, and he didn't realise that it was. That it actually had this firewall on it, and he got very upset because about six of us had all written back to him on the mailing list going, make sure you don't have any, you know, he was trying to do network sharing and it just wouldn't work, and about six of us wrote back on the mailing list saying, make sure you don't have any firewall, make sure you don't have any firewalls installed. And you can actually see this dialogue in the archives back in mid-2007. And in fact, one of our mutual friends who will remain nameless sent off a very sarcastic email about, well, just looky, you've got something installed. And this fellow had got quite a bad dressing down on the mailing list about not going into his ad remove programs dialogue and seeing what was on his computer. We ended up separating the two of them. I think we threw a virtual bucket of cold water over the two of them, but there was actually quite an argument out there for a while.
Well, Go ahead, Jackie.
In situations like that, I like to run a program called either Hijack This or Silent Runners, and just see what's on the computer and starting up, because you can learn an awful lot from either one of those two little pieces of software that can help you a great deal when it comes to, you know, trying to ferret out what processes are running and what, you know, firewalls might be lurking behind the scenes.
Yeah, and even just getting your computer when it's new, just going through that dialogue in that remove programs just to find out what to put on it.
We usually have the uninstall the cruft session on our new netbooks. What is on there that we don't want? Goodbye Microsoft Works, goodbye Norton Anti-Internet, goodbye all sorts of things that disappear off the network.
And all the turbos! Oh, God.
Well, the other thing that I usually used to do was I used to actually, when I had more site of assistance, I would actually do a clean build of XP and rebuild the netbook up from clean Windows and drivers, but now that that's less accessible to me, I tend to go through and actually take the things off that I don't want.
Jackie mentioned a very interesting program called Hijack This, which is a program that you can not just use for that, see what things that the vendors, but you can also use it to check for other things that, like spyware and malware as well. So there's plenty of tools around that will like Hijack This actually. Make a log file and you can read the log file and check back to see what processes are running and...
Just give that mic a shove, at least it's just shifted a little.
Yes, it's shoved
away. There we are.
That's better.
Okay, we've come back, that's good. Yep, okay.
Please don't use that program unless it's under the supervision of somebody who knows what they're doing, unless you yourself do, because it tracks legitimate as well as bad stuff.
So if
you start removing all of the processes on there and you don't know what those processes are, you'll bring down your computer. So just a word of warning.
Grace and I'll put a mirror up on our desk because that way we can have somebody with us that knows what we're doing. And that goes for a lot of these tools, guys. I hate those tools that come up with a message box that say, "If you're seeing this message, please contact your network administrator." Well, it's now time to sit on the couch and have a little Zen session because I'm the administrator. But I think this goes without saying, people. If we recommend anything on this channel, you are expected to know what you're doing with it, and if you pull it out and you do break it, you do get to keep both pieces. We will not be held responsible for a bull in a china shop with a lot of these utilities. They have great power, but with great power becomes great responsibility, and I can't be bothered Googling up who originally said that, but it's true. These little Swiss Army knives are absolutely magic for what you need to do, but they are incredibly powerful and in the wrong hands. ..
Wow, there you go. So, yeah, we're all expected to know what we're doing because we're all IT professionals and IT students.
Or if we don't, we can email the mailing list and ask. There we go, just had to get that in.
Scrolling here.
You do actually, Jenny.
Okay, because...
Go ahead, Liz.
Because of the constantly changing threats, and this sort of gets back to everything, a computer technician or administrator or IT professional or student, in other words us, should be aware of these things and have at least some idea of what to do when things go wrong. Because the security landscape is changing. It's very different now than what it was, say, 5 years ago. It will probably be different in another 5 years' time. So it's something to be very, very constantly aware of. A way you can do this, of course, is applying to your operating system, whether it be Linux or Windows, is patches.
Sorry.
Oh, somebody said on the chat, thank you for the comment of having a Zen session on the couch. They've just spilt Coke all over themselves. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Sorry, whoever that was who said that.
That was Amanda, it's okay. We're sorry Amanda. About that. These lectures are actually a laugh a minute, and in fact, if you go to www.qcat.org/ciscojokes, you can actually download an archive of some of the old funny things that were sliced out of lectures by my ex-wife, who was very sick and very bored and needed something to keep her happy. So she used to listen to our Cisco lectures and slice out the funny bits. So www.qcat.org/ciscojokes, you can get all sorts of funnies from the old lectures.
I think it's about time we actually renewed a few of those.
We should do some more.
Yeah, we should. We should do some more.
Who gets to rip them out?
I don't know, Grace. Here's your chance to learn sound editing. No luck there.
All right. Patches and updates. Yes, we need to put up. We get these little reminders. Security updates or updates are available for your computer. Click here. And we like to generally, under most circumstances, install them, or at least to install them manually and be aware of what we're actually installing. Windows out of the box will want you to install at 3 o'clock in the morning, and basically you can do that, be wary. But yeah, look, putting the patches on, making sure your operating system is up to date is a good idea, and this also goes for the Linux people as well.
I also found a couple of things the other day in my Googling, just quickly. There's one that's called the Windows Updates Downloader, which will download all of the Microsoft updates and drop about 300 KB files into a directory. We've got a mutual friend who just loved that, and I have to tell him about it. There's also another one that was in a website that was German, and when I finally got to the download link, the actual scripts are actually in English, but it actually downloads all the updates and makes you a CD with an auto run, where you drop the CD in onto a fresh box, and it just applies all the critical updates, and you come back after about 6 cups of coffee and you're up to date, and you've only got about 3 or 4 patches to pull down rather than the usual 40 or 50. Or another Zen session on the couch, preferably without the Coke.
It's a silly question. It probably does the service packs as well, this thing you're talking about, Kerry.
Well, in fact, it will do the service packs, but what you can actually do is you can say, I am at service pack 3, get me everything since then. Or if you say, I'm at service pack 1, it will get you service pack 2 and 3, apply both the service packs, and then all the cumulative updates. Very powerful. Some shell scripting with some wget magic.
I'd like to just say one thing here real quick, another war story, I guess, but a couple of months ago, I actually had a Windows update crash my machine, and I ended up having to do a .NET 2.0 repair, and that is not trivial, ladies and gents. It is not. And so one of the things that I think is I have set my machine to download but do not install the updates until I say so, and then I always create a restore point prior to installing the updates so that if something happens like that, what it actually did was it prevented my virtual cursor and JAWS from working. Now, somebody explained that, but and it ended up getting, you know, I did have to do a restore point, but then I had to do a .NET repair because it ruined my .NET, so... Mm. I'm just saying, sometimes these updates can be kind of tricky.
Actually.
Yeah, that's why I was very particular in saying, watch what you're doing with them for that reason. Go ahead, Kerry.
I was just going to say two words, Windows Secrets. And if you've got $5 or $10 US, you get the paid one, because there's a column called Patch Watch, and it's brilliant. You actually, in fact, when Patch Tuesday hits the world, Windows Secrets comes out on Thursday, and you should probably hold off till Friday. This is American days here. And then load those patches on after you've read the Patch Watch column to see whose machines blew up. There was one that actually murdered the Realtek sound manager, and that was a showstopper for JAWS users. Nasty stuff.
Oh, yeah. Big showstopper. Here we go. Some manufacturers release patches and updates on the same day every month. Whoa. Patch Tuesday. Manufacturers provide automatic update services, yes, Microsoft, and you can simply, automatically do it, but of course you end up in some of these problems that Jackie and Kerry and I have just been discussing. Scrolling here, guys. Okay, basically after you've completed this section, you'll understand how to install security patches, so I would certainly encourage people out there to read their notes, and there are probably some labs out there on it. It's been a little while since I've done this course. What else we've got here? Oh, we have a section here on signature files for our antivirus and anti-spam and anti-everything else software. So, yes, obviously part of being a network administrator and a system administrator is to be aware of the fact that your virus software will, of course, need to be updated on a regular basis, because the little hacker crackery people are out there writing new ones all the time. So whilst they're busy, the vendors of your favourite virus scanning program are also busy trying to keep up. Attackers constantly look for new ways to infiltrate computers and networks. Virus updates can be performed automatically, but a technician should know how to manually update their software manually anyway.
If you live in Western Australia and you're disconnected from the internet because your income doesn't preclude you having the internet, then having AVG and a floppy disk is a very good way to get your virus updates every 4 months when the technician gets to your house. So seriously, people, you do need to know about how to do offline updates, especially with things like AVG. It is possible to drop the definitions onto a thumb drive and drag them out to Joe Blindy and load them onto their computer because they don't have internet access. And a lot of the times you will actually find that if you assume people have internet access, you'll go out somewhere to do some work, and sometimes people don't. And that can often put a lot of your carefully labelled tech, I'll just Google this up at their house plans, on hold, because they don't have any internet and your mobile dongle doesn't work in their lack of coverage area. So just be aware of that. Whilst it's important to use internet for about 90% of your research or 95% of your research, don't become an internet Google drone bot. Do actually have some knowledge and learning and stuff that you can apply when the internet doesn't work, because that's when that knowledge will serve you well.
Yep, good point. Especially in a state as big as this one, Western Australia, there's probably some plenty of people out there who never get reliable internet. Out there in the desert. Okay, yeah, it's basically talking about signatures, what a dissignature is. We're just talking about all that, so... Oh, yeah, a lot of the updates are on the website, which is just goes exactly in the opposite direction of what Kerry just said. yes, in a lot of circumstances, yes, you can obviously use the internet, but you just don't know whether it's going to be available at the person's place or whether you get to their place and you find the internet is completely broken and you have to fix it. Okay, you can use it to scan your computer after you've updated your virus software. Okay, when your scan is completed, check the report for viruses and other malware. Don't just close it. And you may need to manually delete some stuff yourself. Okay.
Yeah, website's getting heaven again. Isn't that wonderful?
Are we?
Yeah, it's okay. We'll manage. We're almost done. But somebody's hitting qcat.org quite hard, so, yeah.
Okay, it's basically going on about how, you know, make sure you download... There are software, you know, there are tools for removing viruses and that sort of stuff. So anything you download, make sure you download it from a legitimate source. Okay.
In fact, you read all those things on those Linux pages going, check the MD5 sum or SHA-1 sum of the downloaded ISO image. Mate, if I had a dollar for everybody who didn't do that, I'd be richer than Gates.
Okay, let's talk about service packs. We talked about that. And I think we're just about there for the day, to be honest.
Yeah, read your notes.
You know, one thing about signature files is that when these antivirus and anti-spyware softwares, they actually look for certain strings of, it's not text, but code in the files that are suggestive of virus activities. Now, that's what I mean by a signature. And interestingly enough, sometimes, folks, these can result in what's called false positives. So the program thinks it's a virus because of certain strings that the file has in it. And it's especially true if you're a programmer and, you know, you use some of these tools, or if you're like me into forensics and security and stuff like that and are using these tools, I get a lot of false positives. But just be aware that sometimes these can cause some false positive things to come up.
Oh, yeah. We saw it last year with the link between Melbourne and Darwin, and my uncle didn't get a chance to click the ignore button, and my auntie had somebody in who was helping her find a job at the time, as I used to call her, Mrs. Government. Mrs. Government saw it, went, quarantine, and broke my VNC, and I wasn't very happy. So you do get those sort of things. So you need to be really, really wary. Often it's not a wise idea just to go quarantine or break straight away. And as a network administrator, it's part of your job.
It used to be that some types of jars would come up in antivirus software. And like a week ago, part of WindowWire came up and spied on the spyware.
Just move that back just a smidge.
Well, that's a scary thought. Quarantine half that good by a screen reader. Woohoo, not good. Well, I think here endeth the lesson. And if there's any other call, we'll have some comments. And then we'll go into the quiz, if that's all right with everybody.
I was just going to say real quick that this was a while ago, but my computer was having just problem after problem. And I checked out a product called Stop Sign or something. Something like that. And I put it on my computer. I made it found all the stuff, and then I just basically screwed my computer up even more. Because I really, at that point, didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, actually, some of these PC Pit Stop, I think PC Pit Stop is okay, but some of these online, optimize your computer in 60 seconds, free scan. What they don't tell you is that the scan is free, but the fix isn't. And sometimes these programs can actually make more of a mess than what they solve, so be careful which ones you run.
Mm. Absolutely. If it pops up and says you have a virus in your internet browser and asks you for, and says you can pay to fix it, probably don't.
Well, that's why we're all here learning IT, guys, so we know about these things. Are we ready for the quiz?
No, but let's get on with it.
Okay. Oh, poor old Kerry.
Well, actually, do you want to duck out to the GDDC, Luz, and come back in 2 minutes, and then we'll do the quiz, because that way you'll be able...
Okay, question one. What characterizes a DDoS attack? Options. A. Many hosts participate in a coordinated attack. B. It takes only a short time to set up. C. Home computers with internet connections are not susceptible. And D. It is easy to determine the intent of a packet. Go now. Oh, look at them go. Everyone who got A is correct, of course. Two threats. We'll have to do this as a yes-no job. Which two threats are physical threats? Laptops are stored in an unlocked cabinet. Okay, the next answer, which is B, antivirus software has outdated virus definitions. We're talking physical here, guys. All users use one generic username and password to connect to the network. Yep, excellent. Everyone who got N, which is everybody, is correct. The network server and network equipment is kept in the corner of the office.
Have you been to Cavi? Yes, the servers are in the corner.
They're in a room, but still, it's easy to get to.
No, there's a Spark that's the proxy server sitting on the corner of the bench you're sitting at, just over to your left there. So if you have a hammer...
Oh, okay. I got a hammer? Okay, bang. All right. What's this? Oh, yeah. The secure to the desk for each user. Interesting question. It says here, the computers are secured to the desk for each user. Interesting response, because I've now lost what the original question was. Which two threats are physical threats? Yes, the computer being secured to the bench for all users is, well, I wouldn't say it's a physical threat. Unless you want to unbolt it and throw it around the room.
I thought it was Kerry if you got the answer wrong.
Okay, which type of security threat installs to the computer and then monitors all computer activity? Oh, without the user's knowledge and then monitors computer activity. A. Adware. B. Greyware. C. Malware. D. Spyware. Go now. Any other responses? For the people who said D, you are correct. Oops, somebody got it wrong. Yeah, you same finger, different row, right? That's your story and you're sticking to it.
I thought it might have been a brain slip.
Okay. Which type of security threat uses email which type of security threat uses email that appears to be from a legitimate sender and asks the email recipient to visit a website to enter confidential information? A. Badware. B. Phishing. C, stealth virus. D, worm. Go now. Everybody who got B, which is all of you, are correct. Jeez, we're all going well today, aren't we? Question 5. We'll do this as a yes-no, because it's one of those. Question 5. A technician is attempting to secure a wireless network. Which two options should be performed to secure access to the network? Choose two. Okay. One, change the default administrator access for all... change the default administrator access for all access points. Yes or no? Yep. Yeah, everyone's saying why is correct. Okay, basically what it's saying, Jackie, is change the default administrator password on the ISR. So, yes, everyone who gets an ISR, don't leave it set to password. Okay. The
you
access
broke
point.
Up a little, that's why I had trouble.
Oh, okay, right, sure.
And breaking up is hard to do.
Now with Ventrilo, it's not.
Well, with any time-sensitive VoIP, it's it tends to, unless you've got jitter buffers, which slow everybody down.
Okay, another answer. What was the question? Oh, we're trying to secure a wireless network. I know, Stu. We're trying to secure a wireless network here. Okay, next question, next answer. Yeah. Install a security appliance to stop all wireless traffic. That's what the question says. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, now enable the broadcasting of the SSID for one access point. No. Use MAC filtering. Ooh, mixed bunch here, guys. Finish them all off. For those of you who said why, you are correct.
Use MAC filtering. Yes.
MAC filtering.
It's MAC filtering time at McDonald's.
I was just going to say, that's where you put a MAC filter in
the McDonald's.
That was unintelligible on Ventrilo. Everybody went off at once.
No, I can see I'm going to have to listen to this on the plane on the way home tomorrow night to figure out what got said. They might, yeah, but it won't be the meet and assist people from the airline, right?
You'll go to the pretty weight room.
Yeah.
I'm coming to take her away,
ha ha. Where? Trees and cars and flipping roads. I don't know. We're in Cabby, that's where we are. Okay, use a default SSID values for each access point. Yes, all the D-links.
Graham would point out at this point that we've already given two yeses, so we're done.
Oh, all right. Yeah, okay, fine.
Said choose two.
Oh, no. Okay, a technician has configured a wireless network with web encryption. Several users were able to use the wireless network, but now can't. So, what is the probable cause of the network connectivity problem? Web is a strong encryption technique that requires a strong handshake to authenticate. No takers.
No, this is I assume this is an A, B, or C, or D. So we're waiting for you to read all of them.
Oh, sorry, A, B. Oh, sorry, yeah, of course. Yeah, sorry. Okay. I've lost the plot. I'm on holidays, guys. Give us a break, right? Okay, the access point cannot broadcast SSIDs when web is enabled. That's question B, answer B. Okay, C, the users have not configured their computer for web encryption.
Web.
D, web, sorry, web encryption. D, I lost the cursor now. What's happened with... Okay, the question, answer D is the access point uses 64-bit encryption, which is now obsolete with newer wireless, and go now, basically. C is the answer you want. Yes, everyone got it right, even though I mucked it all up. Question 7, which step should a technician perform first when troubleshooting security issues? A, gather data from the computer. B, gather data from the customer. C, evaluate the problem. D, verify the obvious issues. Go now. Great, everyone saying B. Oh, someone said A. Another finger slip. Gather data from the computer. Well, yeah, I suppose you could, but... Gather data from the customer is the right one, and we're going to learn a lot about this when Grace does her help desk one next week, because we need to find out from the customer what they were doing at the time that their problem occurred. Yes, they were refocusing their hard drive. That stops most things. Which protocol was designed to... Which protocol was designed to provide security for WAP? Or WAP devices or WAP devices, and efficiently uses bandwidth? Okay, I'm not sure that we covered some of this. A is SETTLS, which is SETTLS. I'm not sure that we covered this, did we, guys?
You mentioned something about it. You mentioned the wireless TLS thing. You did mention something about the wireless
TLS
thing.
Yeah. The wireless, yeah. TCP SEC, which is B. TTL, which is option C. WTCP, which is option D. And WTLS, which is option E. Go now. You might have to refer to your notes because we briefly covered it. Have a guess. He's correct. Yep. And here endeth the quiz.